Thanks very much indeed, Robert and friends. It's a great pleasure for me to return to the Kreisky Forum on the occasion of the publication of Inequality and Instability, this book that you graciously mentioned in your introduction. It is a study with a long lead time, and it contains quite a lot of technical material, which I think I will largely spare you this evening. What I want to do tonight is to build on the arguments that were made in this book, but also to go beyond them in order to speak directly about the economic and financial crisis and that we are facing, and which is clearly accelerating these days as we observe it in the daily press, and to talk about the relationship between the work that I've done on inequality and the phenomenon of economic inequality and these ongoing events. So in some sense, I want to talk about the book that is not yet written, the one which is under contract and is due at the end of the year, and to which I plan to dedicate the next few months. We are at a moment when synthetic accounts of the crisis are beginning to appear. That is to say, 4 years have now elapsed since the events that led to the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the dramatic coming to head of financial developments in the fall of 2008. And we have seen a number, in fact, a sequence, several waves of accounts of these events. The first being journalistic, the immediate stories of the major players in the banks and in public policy. The second being the memoirs of the officials who were involved in some cases, but also the official investigations, which in the case of the United States have been quite comprehensive, quite thorough, and coming from a number of highly interesting and important investigative bodies, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, the Congressional Oversight Panel into the operation of the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And now what we are seeing is something that has a little more remove and a little more perspective. That is to say, the interpretations coming from such figures as my friend Paul Krugman and my friend Joe Stiglitz. And these are just emerging, and I'm going to wait until I've seen a few of them in full and had a chance to read them before I start to write mine, so that I hope to have something close to, closer to the last word. I see these in synthetic interpretations that are emerging as consisting of perhaps three or four distinct types. There was an initial interpretation of events which basically said that the crisis was due to bad policies operating in the context of good markets. And this was the broad interpretation that I think formed the backdrop of a lot of discussion on both sides of the Atlantic. In the United States, initially, and through a certain number of dissenting opinions to official investigations, the theme that was offered was that the government had overdone its interventions into the housing market, providing essentially an environment of deep moral hazard, and that this was fundamentally the issue, the cause of the meltdown in the market for mortgages. Corresponding to this in Europe, one has a line of interpretation which holds that feckless and irresponsible governments, overspending in the case of Greece or failing to tax enough, got themselves into trouble and lost the confidence of the markets. Or similarly, one looks at Ireland, one looks at Spain, and you have the phenomenon of irresponsible investment in commercial real estate or in residential real estate, and again, a collapse of the confidence of the markets, for which the remedy is to restore a sound policy, that is to say, a policy which is in line with the canons of sound finance. The second and more recent line of argument takes the phenomenon of the collapse as somewhat of a given, as a, something that is taken as part of the historical backdrop, and asks, why is it that we have not recovered, and assigns the blame to incompetent public authority. And this is essentially, I think, the major theme of Paul Krugman's new book, which is titled In This Depression Now, with an exclamation point. Now, when someone puts an exclamation point in the title of their book, you know that they have something that they really want to get across. and I think that Paul's central argument here is that there was a failure on the part of public authorities to recognize the need to be aggressively expansionist in their policies, to be what Paul would call an aggressively Keynesian policy. That is to say, the Republicans in the United States, and to some extent the Democrats as well, the official economists, failed to agree on a sufficiently large expansion or stimulus package. And the corresponding villain in the European setting is, of course, the Germans, who have resisted the proposition that they should be backing a massively expansionary policy for the governments and peoples of the periphery of Europe. And then there is a third body of argument, some of which actually anticipated the crisis by a substantial period of time, but which offers a substantially more pessimistic lesson. That's to say, an argument which holds that the problems that we face are not so easily remedied by a change of attitudes and policies. I call this a body of structuralist work. One of the lines, long-standing line of argument here, is a Marxian or post-Marxian perspective. And one has to give the remaining Marxians in academic life a certain amount of credit for having correctly foretold the possibility of a crisis of capitalism. The difficulty with their position, of course, is that this has been their position for a century, and the crisis of capitalism only happened once in that period, well, maybe twice in that period of time. So one has to be somewhat, balanced in one's assessment. It's also true that the Marxian position rests on deep questions of conflict and incompatibility in class relations in society, on deep issues of power and concentration of power under capitalism. And it's not specifically financial. So if one believes that what is happening here, what happened here had an essentially financial character, it's perhaps not the most nuanced and direct guide to it. For that, we have Hyman Minsky, the American economist who dedicated his career to a very close study of banking systems and their propensity to get into trouble. Martin Meyer, a great modern historian of economics, is writing a book entitled The Man Who Got It Right, Hyman P. Minsky and the Economics of Trouble. A wonderful title. I wish I'd thought of it myself. But Minsky and his followers always emphasized that finance under capitalist institutions was intrinsically unstable because periods of stable growth breed confidence, a drive for higher and higher profits, a reach for yield, which ultimately cannot be satisfied except by degrading the conditions of credit and getting yourself into a position where your positions cannot be covered and cannot be repaid. So that's the second position, one with which I have to say I have a lot of sympathy. And then there is a third structuralist position, which in some ways I think is emerging as a consensus viewpoint in parts of the mainstream of economics. And that's of particular interest this evening because this position is taking up economic inequality as a potential causal force behind the crisis. So not improper government policies with respect to stabilizing markets, and not the failure of governments to react sufficiently, and not the intrinsic instability of finance, but rather the underlying inequalities in society. Now, I have spent many years, of which this book is a product, studying inequality. I have to say, I wrote the book in advance of the development of this narrative. And you will not find an account of the narrative in the book. When a narrative emerges, however, in economics very rapidly as an interpretation of events, my instinct is to become suspicious, is to become wary and skeptical. So I want to spend a few minutes describing what that narrative is, and then to give you the reasons why I think the analysis of inequality that I have given in this book tends toward a different position. So, did inequality cause the crisis? What is the argument? The argument, first of all, takes the rise of economic inequality as a fact, and attributes it primarily to phenomena in the labor market. That is to say, to things affecting the distribution of wages. And mainstream economists have been making arguments studying this phenomenon for quite some time, and they have typically imposed on it a very strong set of prior views, according to which the principal driving force behind rising inequality is technology. And technology works on the labor market by changing the mix of demands for skill relative to the supply, rewarding people whose preparation is better adapted to a new workforce environment. Anyway, it's something which therefore you would expect to be suffused through the labor market. That is to say, for the difference between every sort of worker and every other sort to be getting larger, as the universe, in the same way that the universe is expanding and every star is moving apart from every other one. Okay? Something, in other words, which is runs throughout the entire distribution. The second piece of the argument takes up a fairly old idea in mainstream macroeconomics, derivative of Keynes's theory, an idea which was, however, neglected for the first 40 or 50 years of its existence, and that is the theory of Professor James Duesenberry at Harvard in the early, late 40s, early 1950s. This was known as the relative income hypothesis. The idea that people's consumption is strongly influenced by that of their neighbors and that they have a very strong demand to keep up. Right? And so you have the combination of these two thoughts. Number one, incomes are getting much more widely dispersed. And number two, everybody wants to consume the same as everybody else, leading to implication number three, that people go into debt in order to do this. Right? And therefore, and one can look at apparently corroborating evidence, you would expect, particularly in the US case, to find debt-to-income ratios rising in the household sector, and this is ultimately going to get people into trouble. And you could make a similar argument for Europe, except you have to substitute countries for people, or at least, right? Or at least groups of people organized by nationality. And then you have, okay, a tendency for the rich to get richer, for the Germans to become richer relative to the Greeks, and for the Greeks to want to keep up, and so they have to get into debt to do that. Becomes the same story, just organized in a slightly different way. What do we make of it? It certainly has an air of plausibility, and it has the increasing authority of prominent economists articulating it. Raghuram Rajan, for example, uses this story in a new book called Fault Lines. It also has an interesting appeal to people on the center left, to progressive political voices in the United States, because it accepts the importance of rising inequality and suggests, okay, that this was not only important for its own sake, but a driving force behind the crisis. Why am I uncomfortable with it, particularly as a figure of the center left? Perhaps I should just jump on board. I can't quite do that. And let me explain to you why not. It's based upon the work that's in the book that I've just published. First is that, especially when you look at the United States, which you can look at very carefully, you discover that the rise in inequality, which occurs, and which, by the way, peaks in the year 2000, already 12 years ago, and 8 years before the crisis, is principally a phenomenon of the highest incomes. It is not a phenomenon of massive changes in the whole structure of wages. The structure of hourly wages is something, in fact, we don't have a lot of information about, but to the extent that we do, it actually appears to be quite stable. Not totally stable, but more stable than you would have thought. And the inequality of weekly earnings in the working population actually goes down in the 1990s with full employment because lower income people work more hours. So their incomes go up more rapidly. The pulling away is at the very top. It's a handful of people in a handful of places. Let me give you an example from a piece of analysis in the book. Suppose you measure inequality across the counties of the United States. A good way to do it, we have more than 3,000 counties. They're very small geographic units. Okay? You can measure the change in average incomes of each county. And then you say, well, suppose we eliminated one county from the data, the county that contributes the most to rising income inequality in the 1990s. Which county is that?
New York.
New York, New York. State of New York, County of New York, which is called Manhattan. Right? And if you say, well, what would have happened if that county had just the average increase of income? Well, maybe 20% of the total gain in inequality goes away. Now do the same with four more. There are three in California: Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco. This is Silicon Valley. And one in the state of Washington, King County, which is Seattle, headquarters of which company? Thank you. Take those five counties out, and half of the rise goes away. Take the top 15 out of 3,150 and all of it goes away. This is a phenomenon concentrated in an extraordinarily small geographic space. Okay, rich people like to live within walking distance of each other, we know that. But the extent to which they do in the United States is truly remarkable. Okay. Second point, did middle class consumption really rise that far ahead of incomes? That's very doubtful. It's very doubtful in the broad middle class that this is a great phenomenon. And to the extent that their debts did go up, you have to recognize that their interest burdens went down. So they were not that financially stressed until the end. Whose debts went up in this crisis? People at the bottom. People who previously did not qualify for loans at all. Now, were those people somehow motivated by jealousy about Larry Ellison, Steve Jobs, and Bill Gates? I don't think so. Let alone Lloyd Blankfein and Richard Fuld. I don't think so. In fact, I know not, because we have a very good account of what happened in the lower income neighborhoods of urban America, places like Cleveland, over this period. Lower income households were beset by people intent upon selling them loans, intent upon getting them to take out mortgages, which had low teaser rates that were going to go up in 2 or 3 years. Half of those mortgages were for the purposes of giving them cash. To do what? To finance boats and vacations? I don't think so. Leaky roofs, medical bills, urgent educational expenses. All kinds of desperately needed things that people chronically in that spectrum of the population have trouble financing. They've got the opportunity to do that, but under conditions that destroyed their capacity to stay in their houses after 3 years. This was a very different sort of story. What's the difference? The difference is that the agency is not in some abstract middle class attempting to keep up its consumption standards. The agency is in the lenders who are attempting to make money on the extension of the loan and have to find a client market that can grow very rapidly. The market for people who already can get mortgages is basically saturated, doesn't grow very fast. So it's the market for mortgages that will not be repaid that grows rapidly. All right? And that's a very different story. Because if you're making loans that will not be repaid, then you have to find someone to hold them and take the loss, which hopefully will not be yourself. You can make money in two ways. You make the money on the origination of the loan, and you make the money on the securitization of the loan. Someone, however, has to hold the securitized instrument, which has been thoughtfully rated AAA because of over-collateralization by a helpful ratings agency for whom 80% of their cash flow was in the rating of securitized mortgages. And then sold to someone who thinks that a AAA mortgage is worth something, a AAA rating is worth something, and that an American investment bank is a reliable and trustworthy partner. And who is that someone? Right? Where did those loans go? In Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, there's a snippet of conversation reported. One investment banker says, "Who's buying this stuff anyway?" And the reply comes back, "Dusseldorf." Okay. This is why I think the mainstream, the new consensus around inequality, is in some sense perhaps deliberately evading the central issue. And if you consider the European question, you've got similar issues, although again in a different framework. It's quite accurate to talk about the profligacy of some of the peripheral countries, let's say Greece, just to take an example. So long as we are aware that in that broad accusation we include things like the Athens Metro, the Olympic Games, and let's say a fair number of battle tanks and submarines which were not made in Greece to begin with, but sold to it by its partners in Northern Europe. The notion that the population was profligate is illusory. The population's the same as it always was. As is the idea that Greece chose its debt position on its own. The fact is that the loans were offered to it because they were mutually advantageous. And the fact that the Greek position was becoming increasingly unsustainable was obscured until the crisis broke and it became unmistakable. And then what happens? What happens is that the two events, the crisis in the United States and the crisis in Europe, are actually the same thing. Because once, in the American case, it became clear that the mortgages were bad, that the assets were toxic, any investor was going to look for weak assets that they could dump. And that would be the weak sovereigns in Europe. So they protect themselves by selling the sovereign debts of the peripheral countries of Europe and buying the German bunds and the British gilts and the US treasuries, which is why the interest rate spreads go in opposite directions on the two sets of bonds. Right? One global event in which there is an entire set of losers whose fate are deeply connected with each other, not individually. So, what does this suggest about the crisis? It seems to me that it suggests that what we need is a broader narrative interpretation still. And I am going to, I think, when I write this up, root the turning point quite a ways back in history, actually in 1970, as the moment when the one period of post-war economic growth came to an end and another period began. The period from 1945 to 1970 was one in which all of our societies grew very rapidly on the basis of very inexpensive resources, so inexpensive that the economics of growth that developed in that period didn't even consider them to be part of the process, part of the model. And if you were raised in economics as I was in those days, and you picked up a textbook on production, you found a production function written with output as a function of capital and labor. Capital's machinery and labor's what you do with your hands. I invite you to try this at home. Have a workshop with a machine. Go there. See what you can produce with your machine and your bare hands and nothing else. Mm-hmm. I think you will find it difficult. That there is a need for something called a resource or a material to use. Right? Present in real life, but missing from the textbooks and from the frame of mind that economists brought to bear. And in the 1970s, we all received a series of shocks about this, incident upon the fact that the sources of energy that we were using became substantially external. Not scarce in absolute terms, far from it, but something that we had to pay real prices to the Middle East for, which caused us a great deal of trouble until we in the United States were rescued for 20 years by Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, who drove up the value of our currency so high that, and drove down the competing, the rest of the world's competition for these resources, so that they became effectively cheap again up until 2000. And that, I think, is basically what happened. We had in that period, among other things, the collapse of the competing system, the Soviet Union, which further drove down resource prices. And we had the rise of China providing a wage goods, shirts and shoes and circuit boards to the world at very low prices, putting a ceiling on the cost of everything that we buy. And we lived very happily off of this, especially we in the United States, but I think everybody did, until 2000, and then this came to an end. For a number of reasons, the main one being the exhaustion of the investment boom related to information technology in the United States. And the last decade is one in which The real cost of resources have been continually going up. A new climate of, let's say, non-hegemony, which has been tested by the American military experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's clear that that illustrated to everybody the limits of any one country's ability to impose its will on the world, and the emergence of a robust competing system in China, whose principal characteristic is that it also absorbs resources at an increasingly rapid rate. So what's going to happen under those conditions? It's going to be more difficult to make money. Profits will be squeezed. It's my thesis. Particularly in systems which have a lot of fixed costs that have to be paid, and whose fixed costs include very large financial systems that don't really do anything but absorb resources enormously. Very big institutions that take, in the US case, 10% of all wages and 40% of all profits at the peak of the boom. All right. What's going to happen if you have a real squeeze in an environment where you are expected to continue to report good financial results? The answer is you're going to cheat. You're going to come under a very strong incentive to bend or break the accounting rules and to bring enormous pressure on your supervisory agencies to not enforce the laws and regulations, if not to repeal them outright. And so, honesty becomes a casualty of this environment. And I think this is very clear. I think this is the political history through which we have been living. The repeal in the United States of Glass-Steagall, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act under Democratic administration, and then in the Bush administration, a systematic desupervision of the banking sector. So FBI agents were withdrawn from the supervision of financial fraud, investigation of financial fraud. The major regulators came on one occasion to a press conference holding a copy of the federal banking regulations and a chainsaw. Not a subtle message. And the loosening up of the leverage requirements for investment banks and all the rest was intended to make it possible to continue to report high profits in the face of a much more difficult environment. And the result was that the most aggressive players in the market took over the market, reporting for a time very high profitability, very high capital valuations, very high personal wealth, giving themselves enormous bonuses. Right? Companies like Ameriquest, the great mortgage originator, which in one account offered its loan officers a ration of crystal methamphetamine to help them improve their sales performance. Was this company connected to the American state? Of course it was. Mr. Arnall, its chief executive officer, ended his career and his, at the end of his life as the United States ambassador to the Netherlands. Right? Confirmed, I think, in 2005. This kind of thing continues, needless to say, only so long as people wish to remain uninformed or in denial. Then it collapses. And when it collapses, we have to recognize that something very profound and fundamental has happened. The collapse infects everything. It cannot be reversed. In other words, this type of event is in contradiction to the possibility of an ordinary recovery of economic activity along the pattern of post-war business cycles, which is what everybody was told by their economists to expect in 2009. but which didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because those previous expansions were basically recovery from shocks to a system that still had its internal structural integrity. And this was not. This was this collapse of a system's trustworthiness. And nobody was going to go back to those derivatives markets, to those securitized mortgage markets. The American household sector wasn't going to go back into debt. Nobody was going to lend to them if they did. And similarly in Europe, although political authorities continued to say if everybody adhered to discipline, the markets would return and restore confidence, the reality was there was no way this was going to happen. Right? Even if you were a creditworthy individual borrower, and there are many in the United States at the household level, prime credits, what does the crisis do to you? It plummets the value of your house, which you haven't sold. And so your lender says, sorry, I cannot refinance that mortgage. Similarly, if you are Portugal, and you are the poster child for good behavior, austerity, or Ireland, 3 or 4 years of rigorous austerity, on what presumption that you are going to be recognized and rewarded for that good behavior, for that compliance? But the lenders say, yeah, you've been complying, but if something bad happens in Spain or Italy or Greece, everybody's going to sell you anyway, so why should I make you another loan? And so you never get out on the basis of your own behavior. The market, in other words, has died. It hasn't simply suffered a shock. It no longer exists in the form that it did until a few years ago. Now that is in a nutshell, and I want to come back to inequality in a few minutes, but that's the story that I think I would tell. And I think it fits the facts of the case. It motivates and explains fraud committed by lenders with the complicity of governments, tolerated by public authority, and in some extent even legitimated by the change in regulatory regimes. It explains also why the Keynesian policy of spending, although it's useful to stabilize activity and prevent a meltdown, prevent a further collapse, just as the monetary policy of providing liquidity to whoever wants it is useful to deflate panic, but why these things will not produce a sustained expansion. Basically, there are two reasons there. One is that liquid funds go to very short-run activities like speculation in commodities, which acts as a kind of choke chain on expansion. So growth rates go up when oil prices go up even more rapidly, which is a tax on activity. And the second reason is that the underlying financial structure to fund a sustained expansion, such as happened in the 1990s in the United States, no longer exists. It therefore explains why, going forward, a restructuring of debt and even a reconstruction of the financial system itself is necessary, and I think inevitable, as part of a policy reconstruction. Of course, there is the alternative policy offered by those in authority and many of their supporters. And that policy is austerity. And if you take Paul Krugman's view, austerity is purely irrational. But I think we can understand that there is, in fact, a kind of intended rationality behind it. The idea behind the notion of austerity is that if you reduce the public sector's take in the economy, you will increase the private sector's take. And so the idea here is to restore private profits, which is a perfectly legitimate goal, so far as it goes. At least I'm not going to argue with it for the purposes of this particular discussion. What I am going to say is that it's a fallacy in the modern world. And I think that fallacy is coming to be recognized in a sophisticated way as we speak in Europe. is coming to be recognized in France with a verdict of the electorate, and in Italy, where this morning the spokesperson for the government said there will be no more austerity measures taken by the Italian government. What is the fallacy? The first is, when you have big governments, you cannot implement an austerity policy independent of the effect on the economy, on activity, on incomes and expenditures. So as you cut, incomes go down, taxes go down, and you're no further forward. And that is why, even as austerity has hit Greece and Ireland and so forth, their total income goes down and their debts in relation to that income continue to rise. And the second point is just a little bit more subtle, but I think more profound. And that relates to the fact that the target of the austerity programs are the social insurance programs, which were built up in social democracies over the period since the Second World War. Well, what about those social insurance programs? I'll make two points about them. First is that they have, universal social insurance programs have declining average costs. The cheapest way to provide them is to provide them to everybody. You provide health insurance to everybody, you don't have to see who's healthy and who's sick. So you save an enormous amount of resources that private insurance companies use trying to determine to make sure they have a healthy pool, because that's more profitable. I mean, this is a very practical fact. The government doesn't have to do that if it's giving everybody health insurance. So the unit costs are low. And when you cut back, you raise the cost per unit on insurance that continues to be provided, and for the people who aren't insured, they either suffer or they self-insure, which means that they save. And when they save, they cut back on their private expenditure. And you get a kind of fanatical rush to safety. It's not just that people aren't spending because they are afraid about their incomes. They're afraid about their healths and their healths and their kids' education and their old age. And you get a kind of pathological excess saving because the insurance schemes are no longer to be relied upon. They are thrown into doubt by the austerity policies. And that is why I would argue this entire approach, the primary reason why it's self-defeating. Well, if austerity is not the answer, and growth is something which is at the very least deeply constrained and maybe chimerical, what do we do? Let me come back to the work on inequality. I think it does provide some guidance. We did some work on the relationship between inequality and employment. And those of you who are old enough to remember economic discussion before the crisis will remember that there was a universal view about Europe and America in that period, which was that you, the Europeans, with your egalitarian sensibilities, had high unemployment because you had all those social welfare programs, whereas we, the Americans, with our flexible labor markets, had low unemployment because we allowed a lot of inequality in our workforce. Well, we looked into this. And what did we discover? We discovered it did not correspond to the facts at all. In fact, within Europe, the more egalitarian countries systematically have less unemployment, more employment. Point number one, that is to say, Northern Europe, right down to Austria, and I'll come to the Austrian case momentarily, did better than Southern Europe on the employment front, at the regional level, at the national level. And secondly, if you take Europe as a single continental entity, which is the perspective of a multinational investor, certainly in recent years, it's also not true that pay in Europe is more equal than it is in the United States, because the differences between Germany and Poland, or between Norway and Portugal, have to be factored in, and they're very large. Okay? So what we discovered, in fact, was that equality had an element that promoted efficiency. And when you think about this, the actual economists have thought about this before, and there are good reasons for it. One of them is that large inequalities promote migration and surge. People leave bad jobs and try to get better ones, and so they end up unemployed. And the other one is that when you compress the wage structure, You attract higher quality jobs, higher productivity, and your income level improves. And so you can support more people in the services sector, and that's Scandinavia for you. That's what's called the Rentmeier model, a foundation of social democratic thought. All right? And then there's Austria, which is one of a few outliers in our case. And what did we find from Austria? We found a very peculiar pattern if you matched Austrian wages to German. They were higher in just about every sector except manufacturing. Oh. So Austria had this lovely position where on all the goods that were not traded, it lived very well, but it was an attractive location to put a manufacturing plant, wasn't it? If you were in the German industrial area. And Austria did very well on that. The advantage of not having a flexible labor market through the collective bargaining mechanisms that prevail. So, equality had an efficiency property. And here I'm going to offer a metaphor. And I'll come toward the end of my talk here. I'm going to offer a metaphor that I think is a very useful way of thinking about inequality. And then finally, some observations about the specific kinds of things that can be done to implement that metaphor in a deeply constrained environment. The analogy or the metaphor that I want to offer is that inequality is quite similar to blood pressure in a biological organism. And here are some of the points where the analogy seems to me to work. First of all, there is a normal range. Not a single figure, but a normal range that connotes a healthy individual. Secondly, within that range, lower is better. Right? We tend to approve of people who are toward the bottom of the normal range, as they seem to be in better health. Thirdly, if you go below the range, you've got a problem. A problem, perhaps, of a lack of dynamism, sluggishness. If your blood pressure, if you happen to be so unfortunate that your blood pressure goes to zero, they take you to the morgue. That doesn't exist outside the cemetery. And what about an increase? A sudden increase in blood pressure, what does that tell you? It tells you you're heading for trouble. It tells you that you're at risk of a crisis. In all of these respects, I think the measurement of inequality that we've done corresponds to that metaphor. So I think it's a good way of thinking about how the analysis of inequality can help inform our thinking about economic society. And further points. Blood pressure is not itself usually a final cause of anything. It can have a whole series of causes. Age, obesity, illness, heart disease. But it is a problem in itself, and it is amenable to being treated independent of the causes. And many people do, in fact, get that treatment. And the same is true, I think, for inequality. It's useful to think of it as an indicator and a problem, not necessarily as a final cause. So that leads me to ask, can we treat inequality as a remedy for economic depression? Well, we discover in the history of depressions, particularly in the United States, this is exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did. He did not have Keynesian macro models, bless his heart, and to his great advantage. What he did have was the idea that you had to support the incomes of the lowest part of the society and provide security so that people could take risks in their own lives and spend their incomes. It was not just spending. The New Deal had an enormous element which is rarely discussed, which was reconstruction of the American periphery, the South, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and a great many other things. And let's just talk about the solidarity measures. Social Security, 1935. The minimum wage, 1935. Fair labor practices. And later on, in the extension of the New Deal under Lyndon Johnson, Medicare and Medicaid, health insurance for parts of the population. Okay. What are these things doing? They are applying on a continental basis ideas that originated in Germanic Europe and came to the United States mainly through the state of Wisconsin and some other states, which would then apply on a nationwide continental basis in the U.S. and have helped ever since to stabilize the system at a personal level and at an individual level. And without, by the way, relying on untrustworthy local or regional governments. The state of Alabama, for example, was not notably honest or fair in its dealings in the 1930s, let alone the state of Texas, where I happily reside. Right? But these measures didn't require that you work through those local elites. Could there be something like this in Europe? I suggest that something is going on the table quite quickly, and that's the Europeanization of the banking system, which is what Roosevelt did in his first days, federal deposit insurance, taking over from state authorities and quelling a run on the banks, which then required creating a federal deposit insurance corporation to regulate the banks independently of the state authorities, which meant you could go into a bank and close it, which they did. That was the equivalent of Social Security, perhaps a European pension union, that would say, you work in Europe, you retire on a common standard. What would be the equivalent of the minimum wage? Perhaps something like the earned income tax credit in the United States, a topping up scheme that says, okay, the bottom end, wherever you are, is going to have a certain central supplement to it. I suggest that if you want to think about the formulas that could stabilize Europe, not necessarily return growth, but stabilize an otherwise unstabilizable situation, something like this would be very useful to reflect on. Will these formulas restore growth in the absence of the discovery of the world's oil supply, which happened in the 1930s? I think not. I'm not going to make that claim. And I would also argue that that's not what we need. As part of our broader requirements in this day and age, we need to come to grips with a world in which we are living comfortably but less ambitiously than we have in the last half century. That is to say, to meet in an effective way our social goals and to find useful ways to use our time as members, participating members of society. In other words, perhaps the right objective is a new period of egalitarian prosperity in which we can actually focus on dealing with the long-term problems that we know face us from the geophysical sphere, climate change, energy, and the other truly transcendent issues of the day. Thanks very much for listening to me to this panel.